This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
Well, seeing as this is the first talk of the new year for me, I thought I would celebrate by practicing my ukulele for you. And my goal in playing the ukulele is to get good enough. But I'm not sure for what yet. So this is the little novelty song that will make us all smile. Spin well, sweet dollar wheel, come and go to wake me up. Spin well, sweet dollar wheel, come and go to wake me up. Well, I sat down and meditated, what did I see? Come and go to wake me up. Band of Buddhas coming after me, come and go to wake me up. Good voice today. You should hear what I sound like when I'm not in good voice. Okay. So this is one more little song just to get us thinking about stuff. This is something was done in 1969, Bobby Darin. And if you don't know who Bobby Darin is, you're probably not as old as I am. But he was like a lounge singer and stuff. And for some reason, he started getting high and he wrote this song. And Tim Hardin actually made it a hit, and then Bobby Darin started to sing it as well. And it's actually, I had to change a couple of the words because the 69 is different than 2012, but maybe not as much as I thought. So here we go. Come and sing a simple song of freedom. Oh, sing it like you've never sung before. Let it fill the air, tell the people everywhere. We the people here don't want no war. Hey there, young and old, can you hear me? Oh, I don't want your diamonds or known to you as me, and I'll bet the farm you want the same. Come and sing a simple song of freedom. Oh, sing it like you've never sung before. Let it fill the air, tell the people everywhere. People here don't want no war. 7 billion people, are you listening? Most of what you read is filled with lies. Speaking one to one, ain't it everybody's son to wake up to the morning when we rise? Sing a simple song of freedom.
host it like you've never sung before. Let it fill the air, tell the people everywhere, we the people here don't want no war.
So if you weren't there in 69, that's what we were talking about. And in 75, the Vietnam War ended, so it took us a while to get that going. I thought, again, because this is the first talk of the new year, I just start at the beginning and sort of reflect on why we're all here today. You know, how did it start 2,500 years ago? And why do we think it still works? And what did the historical Buddha really have to say about what we do, what we practice, what we think, how we act? So I don't think Siddhartha wanted to start a new religion. I think he was fine with his religion. Yeah, he was somewhat of a Hindu, was a Brahmin, it was a different time, different era, and Hinduism is like an umbrella word that covers like 100, if not 1,000 different kinds of religion. But he was a Hindu, and he worked fine with that, but there was a problem. And he found out in his 19th year, when he was 19, it said he went out into the streets of the city and he saw this really old guy, this really sick guy, this really dead guy, and this really holy guy. And it got him to thinking, much in the same way it would probably get us to thinking, why do humans have to suffer so much? Because as we go through these different phases in our life, the first phase is sickness. You know, immediately we're sick, and then our parents are sick, and then we get sick, and then our parents are sick, and then we go to school, and the students are sick, and they make us sick, and it continues through our whole life. And then we get to go to Walgreens and get our flu shots, you know, which may or may not work, depending if they have the new flu shot or the old flu shot. And you wonder who's making all the money off those flu shots, at least I do. So I figure if everybody else gets a flu shot and I don't, I won't get sick. Yes, there we go. He was absolutely right when he looked around and saw that there were a lot of sick folks, and then he saw a lot of old people as well. And he had never really seen a lot of old people, it said, because he was behind the palace walls, and all the people behind the palace walls were sort of good-looking people, and young people, and healthy people. And so he hadn't really seen a bunch of old people. I was at Leisure World yesterday, Seal Beach. They have 7,000 old people in Leisure World. And they're a really nice bunch of folks. I like them. And they always come to the Dharma talk because we feed them afterwards, you know. And it works fine. And that song that I just sang, they would really know it. They'd probably sing along with me, you know. So I don't have to explain a lot when I speak to the old people at Leisure World because I'm old too. And it enables me to sort of see how I'm going to be in 5 years, in 10 years, and maybe even in 20 years if I'm lucky enough. But then they have problems. You know, the old people, like they have the cataracts, and then they're nearsighted, then they're farsighted, and then they can't hear. And then they don't have any hair, and then they can't eat stuff, and then they can't sleep, and then their legs hurt, and geez. You know, and I don't know anybody telling me about that when I was young. They just said, life is wonderful, you know. So I think, as a Buddhist, we sort of need to prepare in a way for that stuff, to sickness and the old age. And then there's the death part. And geez, that's really a bummer. You know, because like everything dies. It's not just humans, but it's like all those pets that you've had, cats and dogs, that lived maybe 10 years and you were really attached to them and you had to bury them, you know, and the fish that lasted about 3 weeks, you had to flush the fish, you know. And you just go, wow. And then all of a sudden your friends die, they might have an accident or they might just be old, or then your parents go. And then all those reference points that you had when they were alive have now gone away, and you can't call them up and ask them what they think, or what you should do, and the more responsibility for who you are seems to fall in your lap. You don't have those folks anymore that you can say, well, I'm this way because of them. Now they're not there, so you're this way because of you. And then he saw the holy person. Thankfully, he didn't go back to the palace too soon. You know, he saw the holy person, and the holy person seemed to be very relaxed and adjusted and accepting of all the suffering the historical Buddha had seen on that day. And so I'm thinking, okay, he realized that there's nothing in the secular path that will lead him to ultimate happiness or ultimate peace. Temporary happiness and temporary peace, yes, but not ultimate. So then at the age of 29, he left his family, became a deadbeat dad for a while. In the care of his parents, though, so it wasn't like they were destitute, they were fine. And he went to find the answer to suffering. And he didn't seem to ask the gods of India about suffering too much, because they seemed to be oblivious to the suffering of humans, or they didn't care. And so he may not have even blamed them for human suffering. He may have said, well, why do I suffer as a human being? If the gods of India are not inflicting the suffering upon me, why am I suffering? And so for 6 years he investigated why he suffered as a human being. It didn't take him 6 years to figure it out, but it took him 6 years to figure out why he suffered and then how to end that suffering. And it wasn't about the annihilation of ego. Some of the older texts that we tend to read when we first get into Buddhism sort of talk about this. And it's not about getting rid of ego, that's for sure, because ego is our friend. Ego is who we are most of the time. Ego allows us to live in a skillful way, for the most part, in our relative reality. The only problem with ego is it limits us. It doesn't allow us to be anything else but who we are. And of course, the big question then is, who are we? And it turns out we're a lot of different things. We're the ukulele player, we're the Dharma talk person, we're the guy that drives the car, we're the guy that feeds the cats, we're the guy that does all these things and more, and has all these big hats on. You know, the hat of the career person, the hat of the male or the female. And then there's the Buddhist hat. Ooh, it's huge. It covers a lot of space. And you can walk into a room with your Buddhist hat and figure it out. As a Buddhist. Cool. But that might get you in trouble too, because people might think that you've been indoctrinated and have become a cult member. Because you use your Buddhism now to understand the reality of your life. But that's what the Buddha sort of figured out. He said, the reason I suffer is because I have a lot of desire and craving and thirst. And no matter how hard I try to satisfy my desire and craving and thirst, I always fail. I can temporarily put it at bay for a while, you know, that desire. I can, you know, if you're inclined to want a mate, you know, you can find a mate out there and do some mating, and all those desires sort of fall away for a while. But then they come back, you know, and no matter how much mating you seem to do, there's always more mating to do. And you're just never quite over it, if you will, you know. And then there's like, you know, wanting to be somebody. I mean, when do you finally give up wanting to be somebody? I mean, look at Colonel Sanders, you know. In his 60s, he became somebody. So in the back of our minds, we figure, well, if I'm not somebody at 30, I got a chance because Colonel Sanders did it. And then we might get 80, you know, and have our first novel and be, you know, known the world around as a great novelist at 80. And so when is it okay not to have the desire to be somebody or the craving to be somebody? You know, and so the historical Buddha figured out that our problem as humans is that we experience the world in an incorrect way. And because of our personal experience of the world, we suffer. And what we need to do is not change the world. The world is fine just the way it is. But we need to change the way we experience the world. and he came up with a system. He came up with a therapy, a literal therapy, thousands of years before psychology and psychotherapy, you know, hit our shores. He was back there with his therapy, you know, and everybody was like, I'm suffering, and, you know, well, did you make your offering to the gods? Yeah, but they don't care. And the Buddha would say, well, sit down and tell me about it, and it could be your mother, but it also could be the way you experience the world. And so he said, I have a prescription for you, and if you follow this prescription, you'll never have to suffer again. And so his prescription to everybody that's into following prescriptions is the Noble Eightfold Path. And the Noble Eightfold Path will allow you to suffer less immediately and ultimately not suffer at all. And so it starts in a very sort of subtle way. The Buddha said, you know, the deal is we have this thing called karma, this sort of process that keeps following us from lifetime to lifetime. And so as a person, as a unique entity, as an individual, as an event, we don't migrate lifetime to lifetime. What migrates lifetime to lifetime is our karma. And he defined karma as everything we think, everything we say, and everything we do. And he said that creates energy in the world. It transforms energy in the world, rather than create it. It transforms this energy in the world and gives it a value, gives it a moral value of skillful or unskillful. And really, what we need to do is transform all the energy through thought, speech, and action in a skillful way, and then we will suffer less. Okay, so he started at a very practical level, because he realized not everybody had time to meditate. Meditation takes a long time. You have to have an appropriate place. You have to know how to do it. And it's so easy to do that most people don't know how to do it. You know? And then you have to do it consistently. And most people aren't good at consistent things. Because, and myself, I'm inconsistent in a lot of things. I always read my email, though. That's one thing. And so I'm, you know, so we set time aside in the morning or the evening for our meditation practice because we want to change the way we think. But before that, we need to change the way we speak, then we need to change the way we act. So the Buddha said the prescription starts with speaking and acting first. And you need to speak and act skillfully, and then you will suffer less. And so he had the five precepts. He gave the five precepts to all the people that followed him. Actually, in the beginning, there were no precepts. You just followed the Buddha, and the Buddha told you what to do. Mm-hmm. Well, that's cool, and that works really good, unless you have like 1,000 people you need to tell what to do. And the Buddha can't be with you all the time. So I finally figured out why we have precepts and why we have laws. Laws take the place of monitors. So we do not have a police person with us 24/7 telling us what not to do or what to do. We have a law that tells us what to do, and it's sort of a voluntary thing up to a point. Then when you break the law, it's not voluntary anymore. Then you have to do it. And they penalize you for not doing it. So they put you in with a lot of people who don't do it, and then they have the people who make you do it watch over you. And then sometimes they put you with a book, and you get to read this book and reflect on how you've been unskillful. And it really works well if you're into the people of the book stuff, like, you know, Christianity and Judaism and Islam. But gosh, if you're a Buddhist and you got this book next to you, it really doesn't have much to say to us, you know, because we don't sin. We're really lucky. We don't ever sin. But we don't ever know what's really ultimately right and ultimately wrong either, because ultimate is sort of God kind of thing, you know. So the Buddha said, you know, we start relatively. It's a relative model for us, and we just watch what we say and what we do. And so we don't kill stuff. We try not to kill stuff. That's how we start. And most of us are pretty good, and some of us need practice. So you might say, okay, I'm going to be a Buddhist. I'm going to take the precept not to kill, but I will fish and hunt. Okay. So that works for a while, and then you realize that when you go hunting, you're actually killing stuff. It's not just a sport, and it's not just fun, and it's not just trophies. You're actually sort of killing things. So you say, okay, I'm going to stop killing deer, but I'm still going to fish, because fish don't really count. and they taste good too. And then you might be meditating enough to see that fish live and have a life as well, and maybe you won't be fishing anymore, but you still kill the cockroaches and the spiders and the ants and the mosquitoes. And that may take a whole lifetime to get past that. But as you practice not killing, you are becoming more and more skillful in the world around you. Fewer and fewer things are suffering because of you. And now you start to see in a very real way your relationship to all the other life in the world. That you are interconnected and interdependent, even if you can't see it or understand it at the beginning levels of this practice. And then the Buddha said, you know, it's not good to take stuff. Because some people don't have much stuff at all. Some people have $10. And you take $5 from somebody who has $10, that's 50%. Man. Now, if you take $5 from Romney, he won't even notice. So it may not affect him, but it will affect you because you broke the precept of not to take stuff. Even from somebody who has like 20 million stuff, not to take anything. Because it's not yours. And then you look at your own stuff and you say, well, is this mine? And you start to realize that your own stuff isn't yours either. You're just sort of using it until somebody wants it more than you do. And you go, well, it's sort of a weird rule that I can't take anybody's stuff if they don't own the stuff, if I don't even own the stuff. But they think they do. And our world turns out to be what we think about it. Not what it is, but what we think about it. And that's a good thing, because we can change our world at any moment, because we get to make it every moment. So sometimes we're the victor, sometimes we're the victim, sometimes we're tired, sometimes we're not. But we're creating all that for ourselves. It's our story, you know? We get to write our story every moment of every day. And we get to include all the people who are around us sometimes, and we get to exclude some of the people that are around us. Because we're writing the story. So I don't like this person. You're out of my story. So it works fine up to a point. But the ego is only relative and only goes so far, and it limits us. And the idea is to maybe there's a way to transcend ego. To be more than you are. To be more than you could be, or would be, or need to be. Maybe you can literally be everything. Think about the potential of that. To have that much potential in your life to be everything, you know? And it wouldn't depend on going to DeVry or someplace, you know? It would depend on you experiencing the world in a unique way. Okay, so now the third thing is like sexual misconduct. We've got to be really cool in the way we express ourselves sexually. Because lust and sex is really like about control and personal satisfaction. And ultimately, it's about children. Nature is really cruel in a way, because we have 7 billion people right now. And I don't know anybody who's signing up not to have any more sex, you know, or not to have any more children. And people don't really have children. I figured it out. They have sex, and children just sort of show up. You know? So the Buddha realized that everybody was going to want to have sex because nature, the universe, whatever that thing is buried deep inside of us and forces us to have sex. You know, and if there's nobody to have sex with, well, we're probably good enough. You know? It's really hard to get past that stuff. And it only happens if you lose your desire for sex. And then you never have to have sex again. And that may not sound like a real payoff to you. Gosh, I'll never have to have sex again. But you know what? You'll have much more happiness and peace. You'll have deeper and more thoughtful relationships. You won't be having control issues all the time. You know? You might even like the person. Wow. So it's actually a good thing. But the Buddha said, okay, if you want to have sex, you know, don't have sex with people who are married, engaged, or don't have sex with children. And that's like paying homage, I think, to the family. Because the Buddha was a father and he was a husband. And he understood how important the family unit was in every culture. And so the first three rules talk about respect the family. And the third rule is respect everybody else. Don't have sex with people against their will. And that was sort of it. So we have like a lot of leeway, you know? If you're a lay Buddhist, if you're an ordained Buddhist, you have no leeway at all. and you suffer, and you only end your suffering when your desire ends. And it doesn't end in taking a precept. It doesn't end in becoming ordained or accepting a vow. It only ends when you're able to see that it's the desire and the craving that's sort of forcing you into it. We take credit for wanting to do it, of course. I was just reading about Joey Heatherton. Anybody remember her? Well, if you look her up and find her in the 70s, geez, huh? No wonder we had so many children in the 70s. You know? And so those things, those sort of like icons, those desirable elements in our life, force us into doing things. And so the Buddha said, well, you got to watch it. You got to really be aware all the time. And it happens because of meditation. Our awareness heightens dramatically. The fourth precept is not to speak unskillfully. We don't want to undermine the reality of other people. Now, if you've been following the presidential campaigns and debates, who's telling the truth? Is anybody telling the truth? What is truth? Is truth by consensus? If enough people believe it to be true, does that make it true? I think so. Does anybody remember when the world was flat? Okay, well, I'm glad you don't. But at one point, the world was flat, and everybody was in, you know, agreement with that. And then somebody was able to measure it and figure out it was round. And then we had this giant paradigm clash. We had the flatlanders, and we had the round people. And who was right? Eventually, enough people crossed over that the world became round again, or maybe for the first time. And so as we went to school and learned about the world, it was always round. You know, all the planets are round. How cool is that? But where does the truth come from? What is the truth? Was it true before when we couldn't measure it? At a relative level, absolutely. That at a relative level, before you could measure the Earth, it was flat. And then because the experience, the personal experience of the Earth was a flat. And then it became round. And so we understand that truth evolves at a relative level with science and political parties and relationships. All these things force us into understanding truth in a particular way. But the Buddha said, well, there's another truth too. There's an ultimate truth. A truth that no one can speak of and we can only point at. And the Zen folks get a kick out of saying it's the finger pointing at the moon and never the moon. And absolutely, every truth we can come up with is simply the finger pointing. But it's never the truth itself. That can be experienced, though, in our meditation practice. And then we have no doubt. Then we have great confidence. And at that point, somebody can tell us whatever they want to, and we'll know it's not true for us. Because what's true to us is what we experienced in our practice. Now, does that make you a Buddhist? Perhaps, but it might make you a secular humanist as well. Or it might make you an atheist or an agnostic. Or it might make you an independent. It could make you a lot of things. And more importantly, it could make you nothing. It might give you the opportunity to start that nobody training earlier than you normally would. Last but not least, not to consume intoxicants. Now, when I took that precept, I changed it. Not to consume intoxicants to the point of intoxication. I ain't drunk, I've just been drinking. You know? And it took me a while to figure out why drinking was a problem. You know? Because Germany, beer is food. And it is. And in Italy, they drink wine with every meal. And I'm thinking, okay, so there actually, alcohol and some drugs can give you a better health. You know? They give you more energy and more alertness, and you know. So what's the problem? The problem is it seems to steal our wisdom. When we get high, we perceive the world in an even more realistic way. And we might be absent-minded as well. We might just forget what the other four precepts are, break them, and not even know we did. And so to have clarity of mind is a very important aspect of the Buddhist path, one of the most important. The other important aspect is heart, to have kindness and compassion. So those two things we're working on all the time, in what we study, in how we practice, and what we don't want to do is inhibit our growth in wisdom and compassion. And alcohol and drugs tends to inhibit our growth. So we all start from where we are, you know? We don't, if you're drinking 2 six-packs a week, maybe 1 six-pack would do it, you know? If you go fishing every year, maybe go fishing every other year. Just whatever, however you can sort of gradually go in the direction of your perfection. Your perfection as a human being. So wasn't he wise in giving us something we could actually do to begin with? Was it just watch what you say and watch what you do and acquire the discernment necessary to differentiate between skillful and unskillful? Okay, so how do we do that? How do we know if it's skillful or unskillful? Two ways. First way is a consequence. So we don't have a divine lawgiver that tells us what's right or what's wrong. So sometimes we have to wait for consequences to appear. Okay, so you steal a car, and then you wait to see what kind of consequence that will be, and sometimes they find you, and sometimes they take the car back, and sometimes they take you too. Okay, so you realize, well, maybe it's unskillful to steal a car. But would there have been an easier way to define skillful and unskillful without having to wait for the consequence? And there is, but it requires mindfulness. It requires awareness. We need to see where the intention is coming from, and we need to be able to evaluate what kind of intention that is. What category does it fall in? So we have four intentions. We have the intention of lust, of greed, of hatred, of delusion. We also have the intention of love, generosity, compassion, and wisdom. So what category does the intention of stealing the car come out of? Well, it's not probably, well, it could be lust. It might be a really cool car. Yeah? And it might be worth a lot of money on the aftermarket, so it could be greed as well. And then you had enough delusion thinking you could get away with it. And so maybe it's not specifically just one category, but maybe a variety of categories come together and create this intention. So you can figure it out before it starts. You can figure it out after it's happened. But when you're in the process of doing it, it's a little more difficult because you're occupied with stealing the car. Okay, meditation. The Buddha said once you sort of get the idea of speaking and acting down, being skillful, then you have to figure out how you're thinking. And we have two kinds of Buddhist meditation. We have the Samatha meditation and the Vipassana meditation, the tranquility meditation and the insight meditation. And if you're curious about those two forms of meditation, on my website, urbandharma.org, you can download the complete Visuddhimagga. It is now available. 900 pages in PDF. Now, this is monumental, though, because ever since the Visuddhimagga was written in the 5th century, it has never been available for free distribution in the way it is now. And it was only a year or so ago when it finally became a PDF. Before that, you had to buy the book. But now it's a PDF for free. It even says for free distribution only. And they go into great detail about how to meditate. This is a meditation manual for the Theravada tradition of Buddhism, for the early Buddhist tradition. And it goes into the 44 different kinds of Buddhist meditation. So we have 40 kinds of tranquility meditation. We have 4 kinds of insight meditation. And the idea with the tranquility meditation is to sort of to bring yourself back into balance. You get together with your teacher, who is now your therapist, because it's not a religious sort of thing necessarily in the beginning. And he looks at you and he says, you like Joey Heatherton too much. So you need to balance that lust out with a little reality. We're sending you to the charnel grounds, and we want you to observe the decomposition of corpses. And then I want you to come back and tell me what part of Joey Heatherton really turns you on. Okay. And so what happens in this exercise, in this practice, is you now are not repulsed by the human form, but you're not quite as attracted to the human form as well. You're sort of in the middle. You have a healthy respect, admiration for the human form. But it doesn't drive you to lust all the time. It may even drive you to love more often than not now. So you come back into balance. And that's what Buddhist meditation really does well. It keeps bringing us back to the middle. And that's why they call Buddhism the middle path. Okay, but now we have insight meditation, four kinds of insight: mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of the mind, mindfulness of mental objects, and mindfulness of sensations. And that's designed to give us a breakthrough, to see the true nature of reality, to change the way we experience the world permanently. And this is what the historical Buddha rediscovered. And he rediscovered it because the 27 Buddhas prior to Siddhartha had also rediscovered it when it had been lost to the world, when that Buddha died. That allowed him to achieve his full perfection. He achieved his nirvana because of insight meditation, not because of tranquility meditation. He came back into balance with tranquility meditation. What's interesting to me, if you read the sutras, you find that the Buddha never did insight meditation after he achieved nirvana. It had served its purpose. It had led him to the other shore. It had made him perfect. He no longer had to worry about his karma, his rebirth, or suffering. But he continued to do tranquility meditation until the very moment he died, because he still had a body, and the body kept getting out of balance. Okay. So what's the true nature that becomes obvious to us in our insight meditation? The true nature that becomes obvious to us, first of all, is impermanence. That everything in this world, everything in our world, everything physically, mentally, is in a constant state of flux and change. There's nowhere to stand, and that causes us to be uncomfortable. It gives us this subtle fear that the good will change before we want it to, and the bad won't change soon enough. And of course, that's exactly how it works, you know? Because eventually you have to leave Disneyland. You just can't live there. Not that you'd want to. But then you have the things like the people in Somalia for 3 months, they were captives of the pirates, you know? And you're just thinking, when is this going to end, you know? And it probably for them did not end soon enough, but at least it did come to an end. So we're stuck with this impermanence. And if we attach ourselves to anything that makes us happy, we know it's only a matter of time until that changes. And if we have aversion to something that makes us unhappy, it's only a matter of time until it arises again and challenges us again. So, the first insight that comes through mindfulness meditation is the fact that everything is changing, and so are we. The second insight that comes to us is the fact that because of all that change, this world we live in and our life and the way we experience it will always be ultimately unsatisfactory. It will never be just the way we think it should be for any length of time. Now, that can be a real downer because, you know, nobody told us that this life of ours was going to be ultimately unsatisfactory. It would be satisfactory if we did all the right things, if we went to school, had a savings account, found the right partner, had 4 beautiful children, had a picket fence and a nice house. If we had all those things, this life would be just the way we thought it would be. And of course, even if you are able to make all those conditions appear in your life, it still does not lead to ultimate, unchanging happiness. So the second truth is, ultimately, this world will be unsatisfactory, no matter what you do. Now that is a good thing. It may not sound like a good thing right now, but it is a good thing because it allows you not to be surprised when your life sucks. Think back to this talk and say, well, of course, how else could it be? So what do I need to do to suffer less? You see, that's the deal. This is our refuge. Our practice is our refuge. So when our life starts to suck, because it always will, we go, yes, of course, but the Buddha said if I do this, it'll suck less. Okay. The third insight that finally comes to us is the fact that we don't exist in the way we think we do. There's an aspect of not self in everything we do. An aspect of not self. And I want to recommend Tanisawa Bhikkhu, who's spoken here. He's Wat Meta, down by Escondido, San Diego. On my website, urbandharma.org, next to the Visuddhimagga, you can download three of his talks, MP3, on selves, not self. Selves, not self. Along with the booklet, it's like a 50-page PDF, for free. Selves, not self. And he goes into great detail with what our challenge is. Our challenge is not simply to be a self. Our challenge is to be a multiple self. We find ourselves selving every day. Selfing every day. We become this, we become that, we become this, we become that. We become the customer, we become the da-da-da-da-da. And there is a continuum, there's a causal connection between all the selves, but none of the selves exist independently. None of the selves are truly and really who we are. They are simply an example of the conditions necessary for that self to arise. So as we arose today, we have a unique self arising right now. This unique self is sitting in against the stream, and it's listening to a Dharma talk, and it's listening to the teachings of the Buddha 25. Wow, that's a really unique self, because that self will not last very long. Because you're going to have to go out to your car, maybe get on the 101 or the 405, and there's another self that's necessary for that. So throughout the day, we're sort of morphing into all these different kinds of people. And the good thing about that is we have no limits. We can morph into almost anything. We can morph into astronauts and politicians and bank presidents, homeless people. We can morph into actors. We can morph into anything. And some of the stuff we don't want to morph into, like politicians, but some of the stuff we might want to morph into. All we have to do is figure out what the conditions are that allow us to morph into that. But then there's the not-self thing. And the not-self thing is just as important as the self. So as we're selfing through the day, you know, we are in control. Self is about being in control. And we have to be different kinds of self to be in control in different environments. But there are times when being a not-self is really good. Like if your favorite pet dies. Who is it that lost the pet? Who is it that mourns and grieves for the pet? Which of those selves? Or is there maybe a not-self that comes to a place of acceptance with the transitory nature of life? You see, maybe we don't have to be anybody except grief. And then that grief will eventually evolve into acceptance and fall away. So in being a not-self, we can use that as a strategy to deal with a lot of unhappiness and unsatisfactoriness in the world. Being a self allows us to be one of the conditions necessary for changing the world. But more importantly, what we're doing in this practice is changing the way we experience the world. And our ultimate goal is to see the perfection of every moment in this world of ours. And this world is exactly the way it's supposed to be, which can be unfortunate if you don't have enough to eat and no place to live. But it's sort of always been that way. This is nothing new. And when we were all hunters and gatherers, if one is into evolution, trying to find a place to live for a few nights and trying to find some game to eat so you can continue your hunting and your gathering. Wow, tough. Really tough way to live. But every little creature that finally gets born on this earth has a tough time of it, from the snail on all the way up to us. No guarantees. Mother Nature is not our friend. Mother Nature wants to kill us. And so we need to learn survival techniques not to let Mother Nature kill us. We've all done well. We're still here. We figured it out. Even in the city of like millions, with all the stuff that goes on, you know? My sister lives in Phoenix, and she's saying, you know, we have murders like once a month now. It was never like that before. And she wanted to get some sympathy from me. I live in downtown L.A. We have murders every day, you know. But that's the way it is. And so can we see the perfection of that? Well, maybe we wouldn't call it perfect, but maybe we can find a way to accept the world exactly the way it is. And in that acceptance, it allows us to have a greater sense of skill in how we change it, how we become one of the conditions necessary for change, and all the while having that balance and equanimity, not choosing sides, not knowing exactly what is right and what is wrong, but who is suffering and who isn't, who calls to us to end their suffering, and who is fine with the way things are. So as I thought about the path and the teachings of the Buddha, I'm lucky I found it as a refuge. And I'm lucky I suffer less now than I did before. But I still suffer. And hopefully my playing didn't make you suffer. And hopefully you all have a good day. And does anybody have a question or comment they'd like to make on what I've said or what I didn't say? Anybody? Yes. Over here? Yes.
Kind of question and comment. You said that Mother Nature is trying to kill us.
Yes.
And I sense some humor in saying that. And I guess part of what I want to say is also that it's also like the perception of what death is and what killing is. Because if we think of Mother Nature as where we came from as well, where every single creature or existence came from,
mm-hmm.
then we know that, you know, like the term ashes to ashes, dust to dust, or like everything cycles, you know. So it maybe even just questioning that approach of like, is she trying to kill it? You know, like just opening the approach up to it's a cycle, and it's not a personal kill, right? I think that's the big
She doesn't take it personally.
And with murder or even death, like not taking it personally, maybe that becomes one of the biggest. And I work with a lot of youth teaching yoga to them.
Okay.
And sort of sometimes have little mini dharma talks with them.
Sure.
But killing is such a huge, or death is such a huge trigger. And
absolutely.
So I just wanted to bring that up.
I think you're absolutely right. Number one, Mother Nature does not have the intention to kill us. But she could care less about us as well. She allows us to live here and gives us what we need, but we have to figure out what it is that we need. You know, I used to be a Boy Scout, you see, and they taught us how to make a fire and make shelter and, you know, and find a path on the way out. But all that stuff came with learning. And if I was plucked right now and put into Angeles National Forest and said, you need to survive, I'd be dead in a couple of days, you know, because I don't have the skills necessary to survive in that environment. I'm more likely to survive in downtown Los Angeles than I am in Angeles National Forest. Isn't that interesting? But in both cases, Mother Nature doesn't care. She doesn't care that I'm here. She doesn't care that I'll be gone.
I think there's no difference between you and Mother Nature. And I think that it's in the acceptance of being that oneness that you don't need a skill.
Well,
you
may be right about that.
You are, and the transformation will occur.
You may be right. Yeah, absolutely. And I'm not saying that you're wrong, but wasn't there a movie a couple years ago about this guy that went to Alaska? Mm-hmm. You know, and he just sort of like, everything was going to be okay, and then he died. And of course, That's our end. We're all going to die.
Yeah.
But all the skills that we learn, you know, through fear and pain to avoid death and to go towards life, that's sort of good. But at one point, no matter how many skills we have, we're going to have to surrender.
Yeah.
Mother Nature will take us back, whether we want to go or not. And at that point, acceptance is a wonderful thing, because then you'll suffer less. But until then, I want to stay alive on the 405, you know. I don't want to get food poisoning at a sea restaurant. And so I have this stuff in my mind that allows me to avoid those sort of pitfalls in life. But then again, you can't avoid them all. And it may, you know, a tree may just fall on me on a busy neighborhood in downtown L.A. Who would have thought? In fact, a woman died, I think, in Burbank or something. They cut down all the trees because one tree killed her. And you just go, okay, gosh, life is really tough. And every day is a miracle, and every moment is special. So good comes out of thinking that Mother Nature wants to kill me. But thank you. And I appreciate your perspective, too. Anybody? No? Okay. Wow. Good. Well, let me close with loving kindness, and then Holly has some updates she wants to tell you about. And then we'll all go have a wonderful day. May those of us who have come together today in mind and heart be happy, peaceful, and free from suffering. May no harm come to us. May no difficulties come to us. May no problems come to us. May we always find fulfillment. May we also have patience, courage, understanding, and determination to meet and overcome the inevitable difficulties, problems, and failures in life. May the suffering ones be suffering free, the fear-struck fearless be. May the grieving shed all grief. May the sick find health relief.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.